This is the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor with Joseph Umar, Executive Director of Secure Free Society. He's traveling. He's in Estonia, the Baltic states, up against the Russian frontier. And Ernesto Araújo, former foreign minister of the Republic of Brazil, he's here with me in North America. Ernesto, the Brazilian election momentarily, within hours, the campaigning is ferocious at this point between the present president, Mr. Bolsonaro, who's identified with right of center, and Lula da Silva, former president, who's identified with left of center. However, in an article I read from the London Financial Times, the pink newspaper, the analysis is that neither candidate is speaking to what needs to be done, which is to grow the Brazilian economy. I believe it's been stagnant or not quite as successful as it was in 2013. There are many causes for this. We have the worldwide recession of 2008. Triggered out of the U.S., we have the pandemic, and certainly we have war right now in Europe causing troubles for everyone, especially a state as dominated by agricultural products to export as Brazil. However, the FT focuses on something called the Central, and that the Central must be moved by whoever is next the leader in Brasilia. What is the Central and what needs to be done? Or what is your analysis of Brazil's stagnant or sideways or not growing economy? Thank you.
So, John, the Central stands for, it means a big center. It's a name that comes from the Constitutional Assembly in the late 80s, where you had some left-wing voices, some right-wing voices, and everything else gathered together in order to reshape the old oligarchical system of Brazil. And that's what they did. Our 1988 constitution is basically geared towards maintaining the power of the political bosses who are the bosses of Centrão. Technically, Centrão is a group of five or six parties with around 40%. In practice, they extend their control to almost the whole political spectrum in Brazil. And they definitely are the problem. The stagnation, economic stagnation that you referred to, comes basically from a bad political system, not from a bad economic system. We have a political system that concentrates all the power in the hands, not of the state as an abstract entity, but of the politicians. One thing is to have your economy depending on the state, which is already bad. Worse than that is to have our economy depending on the political class and the Centrão in that case, and a few cronies. So basically, they built a system of crony capitalism, of monopoly. Whatever is private economy in Brazil is shaped by whether business people are friends with influential politicians or not. So the way towards anything in Brazil is through the political bosses. This creates bad economic performance. This creates corruption, of course, right? It's not by chance, it's part of the design. Corruption in Brazil is not a bug, it's part of the design of the system. And everything, even when it's technically legal, and not bribes or kickbacks, all distribution of resources comes through the power of the big politicians. So they basically control everything in municipal, state, and federal level. So it's good that the Financial Times raises the attention to that. That's the key issue of Brazil. Without a political reform that puts the democratic power back into the hands of the people and not of the political class, we won't go anywhere in the economy or elsewhere.
And what is to be done? Mr. Bolsonaro, the FT says that he doesn't speak to this. Okay, he's campaigning for a large vote. Has the Central decided which side they're going to go with, or does it not matter to them who's in the executive branch? They're going to do what's best for them.
Yeah, well, technically, Central is with President Bolsonaro's campaign. President Bolsonaro joined last year. He joined the party of one of those political bosses who had been imprisoned for corruption a few years ago. Another party is very linked to China, by the way, in his coalition, and they are supporting Bolsonaro, and that's part of Centrão. Another part of Centrão is with Lula. So whoever wins, they will be very much still in power. So President Bolsonaro doesn't address that because he last year something that was very shocking to many people. He said, "Oh, I have always been part of Centrão. I don't know what's wrong with that." And the Lula camp now in the campaign, they don't attack that sort of links of President Bolsonaro because they also want the links with Centrão. So they don't go, "Oh, you're part of Centrão, it's a corrupt group." No, because they also want Centrão votes and Centrão support. So they are the kingmakers. Centrão are the kingmakers in Brazil. And whatever president is elected, they will run the show. With President Bolsonaro, because of his popular support with people who are totally against corruption, we have maybe a 1% chance of overcoming that system. With Lula, 0%.
Do they have a Centrão? Do they have a choice? What you're saying is they'll go either way, but is one or the other better for them? Lula da Silva seems to be state-dominant government, whereas Mr. Bolsonaro speaks of decentralization. But you're saying Centrão can win profits either way. Is that correct?
Oh yes, definitely. They have all the tools in their hands. They manage the system, and they manage also. I mean, they are totally in a symbiotic relationship with the Supreme Court, which is also running the show. There's an editorial, I think, in the New York Times that starts to see the light or the darkness coming from the Supreme Court in Brazil. For the first time, they're not criticizing President Bolsonaro, but criticizing the one of the justices in the Supreme Court as going too far in terms of curtailing civil liberties in order to protect democracy, so they say. People realize that, but no one can do anything. President Bolsonaro has shown that it's very difficult for a president to do anything against that system. So that's what Brazilians are probably going to live with.
Joseph, I come to you because your report does not mention Brazil in particular, although we know that gangs are conducive to trading with bad actors from outside. You don't really care where you get your anti-tank weapon from sometimes. But have you seen, I learned from you and Ernesto that the largest gang in Brazil is the PCC, which is very powerful. I believe it was involved in that assassination of the prosecutor from Paraguay and is a link to all parts of the tri-border region. So is that Brazilian gang and other Brazilian gangs part of this network?
No, absolutely, John, it is. The only reason we don't have them inside this chart that we put inside the report on the drug networks is because we base that report on specific indictments that Department of Justice has presented in 2020. And they don't specifically talk about Brazil in that case. But there's many other criminal actions that have been proved in through the Brazilian judicial system, through the Paraguayan judicial system, and by prosecutors in other countries, because PCC, which is the First Capital Command in English, is present in upwards of 7-8 countries throughout the Americas. It has presence in Venezuela, and it has a growing presence inside Colombia, which is why they were suspected of potentially being involved in the murder of the Paraguayan prosecutor Marcelo Pecci. And what we're seeing, John, we're seeing this phenomenon play out in many countries with many criminal groups, where they start out as local groups that are involved in sometimes even just a city or maybe just a country, and then they morph and evolve into transnational groups. And because the illicit economies are so well connected today, they then become trans-regional groups. So we saw this, we're seeing this with the PCC in Brazil. That's definitely now a transnational group. They don't just have presence in Brazil. They have presence in many countries throughout the Americas. We're also seeing this in what I mentioned with this new group from Venezuela called the Tren de Aragua, the train from Aragua, which that one's astonishing because it went really quick from just being a local group in Venezuela to now a transnational group. And we're even seeing this with gangs from Salvador, like the MS-13 that were started as local gangs inside, some in the United States and in Salvador, notably in Los Angeles and San Salvador, but now have presence as far as Europe. So they're trans-regional. And so what's allowed these organized armed groups to basically become these transnational, trans-regional threats is the illicit economies. And that's actually what Venezuela, what Nicaragua, what Bolivia thrive off of. And this is what we're worried about that's going to happen to Colombia and Brazil if the wrong leadership takes hold.
And Joseph, do you find sympathetic ears in Brasilia or Buenos Aires Bogota to the case that you're making, that to regard this as either immigration or drug trafficking is simple-minded and you're not seeing the scale of it? Do people listen?
So more increasingly so, as Ernesto mentioned, there's always been a resistance in specific countries to try to think of the problem or the threat networks in this lens, partially because of diplomatic fear that they had to address this with their counterparts in some of these more troubled countries, notably Venezuela and Bolivia in the case of South America, but also because in certain lens, they were working off an old Cold War playbook. You asked me this question just a few minutes ago, John, that they were saying, well, okay, if this is all coordinated, then there has to be this command and control structure, right? Like, is there like this group of Venezuelan regime, Maduro regime leadership that's pushing the buttons and making all this work? And so it's taken a while for Latin American governments and authorities to understand how threat networks have evolved from vertical to horizontal. So once they start to get that and they start to see how it really, if you think about it, it makes common sense, right? If you're an accountant for the PCC in Brazil and Hezbollah then knocks on your door, you're probably going to provide your service to Hezbollah as well. You're not a member of Hezbollah or the PCC. You're what's called a service provider. And because you're working in the illicit economy, it makes a lot of sense. So once he started to understand that a little bit, they some of them at least started to get it. But as Ernesto mentioned, there are some resistance in specific pockets in these countries where they just don't want to see it. I worry that in some cases, and I don't want to make this a blanket statement at all, but in some cases, because of the high levels of corruption in Latin America, some of these don't want to see it because they may be complicit in some of the activities as well.
Well, let me ask a specific question. Kirchner, the vice president, who has ambitions to be even more powerful again, is she the driver of these networks, or is she a tool of these networks? In other words, are they so elaborate, so much like an octopus, that no individual, no matter how compromised by past activities, can resist what they want?
So there's two elements that are important to answer that question, John. The first is there's no one individual that's that important that if that individual is removed from the problem set or from the network, that they're not easily replaceable. So Cristina Kirchner is a part of this broader network, what we call the Bolivarian threat network, close to all the Bolivarian leaders in Venezuela and Bolivia and Nicaragua and Cuba and elsewhere. But if she, let's say she gets convicted of the crimes that she's being accused of and goes to jail, that doesn't mean she's going to be irreplaceable. But on the flip side to your question and what you're asking is she a victim of this or is she a culprit of it? Well, here's the thing, John. At the end of the day, anyone could get sucked up into these organized crime networks. But the challenge as a politician, more specifically as a policymaker and a president, which she was to basically have muster the courage to stand up to these networks. And there have been politicians in Latin America that have stood up to these networks. It's not easy to do. It comes often with a lot of cost. Sometimes, I mean, we've seen prosecutors get killed, but it is possible. She's not one of those that did that.
I'm speaking to Ernesto Araújo, former foreign minister of the Republic of Brazil, and Joseph Umar, executive director of Secure Free Society. We're going to go to El Salvador next, not because Nayib Bukele, the colorful authoritarian, is the focus, but a suggestion that a weakness in El Salvador may be a weakness in other states. That is the difference between a constitutional assembly with a president and a parliament with a prime minister. This is The New World Report. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.